Welcome to Loading the Bar with physical training experts Parker McBride and Matt Wasko. Our Fit Lifestyle podcast covers the science of nutrition and fitness, together with the challenges we all face to be disciplined. We'll guide you through the minefields of fads and gimmicks and all manner of BS that tempt us in today's fitness world. Ready to begin?
Okay.
Then let's start loading the bar.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Loading the Bar podcast. Parker and Matt here, back with you guys again on a Super Bowl Saturday.
Yeah.
It is the day before the Chiefs play in Super Bowl 59.
Well, I always know that the Super Bowl is 1 year ahead of my age.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now we know how old Matt is.
Yeah. So, yeah, I shouldn't have said that.
Chiefs and Eagles tomorrow.
Yeah.
We've been predicting games all season, and here we sit tied in the standings, me and Matt.
Yeah.
I think we both have two losses.
I think we're going to end up tied.
Probably, because I'm going to take the Chiefs. You can't pick against them. I've been picking the Chiefs every game all season. I think they're going to get the Super Bowl 31-26.
31-26.
My prediction.
Which will be the first three-peat, I think.
And yep, they'll get the first three-peat. I think Kelce retires after the game.
I think he does,
in the announcement. And
I think he'll announce it after the game?
After the game.
Really?
Okay. Yep, on the field. And I think he may go for the proposal, too.
Oh, well, I think the Kelce prediction should be our tiebreaker.
Okay. Right. That's fine with me.
Okay.
Only if they win. If they lose, I think he still retires, but I think he waits a couple weeks to announce it.
Okay. Well, wait. Here's the thing. Are you taking it on the day of the Super Bowl, or are you going to take the whole week?
It depends on if they win or not.
Okay. So, because I have to be the counter to that.
Okay.
All right. Because I don't think he's going to propose. I don't think he's going to propose to her at the Super Bowl. I'm sorry. Scratch that. If we choose retire, then you think he's going to retire and announce it at the after the game.
If they win, yes.
If they win, okay. Okay. Well, if they lose, we both lost.
If they lose, I think he's still going to retire, but I think he's going to wait, you know, a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And just do it, you know, through a press conference or something.
So I think the tiebreaker can only happen if they win.
Okay, well, what's your prediction then if they win?
I don't think he announces his retirement in the post-game interviews or post-game, like on the field and stuff. I don't think he announces it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that'll work.
And then you think he will. So that'll be our tiebreaker if the Chiefs win.
Okay.
If they lose.
What's your score prediction, though? You didn't give a score prediction.
I was going to say 30-27.
So pretty well the same.
Yeah.
Pretty well the same prediction. We'll see what happens. They've been winning games all year.
Did you say yours?
31-26.
31-20. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. I was going to say 30-27. I don't know. I don't know how they keep winning. You know, but they find a way to win every time. You know, if the game is close, you do not want to be in a close game with the Chiefs.
Hmm.
You know, you just don't. I mean, that's how they win the close games. And better than most teams I've ever seen, if you were going to beat the Chiefs, you got to blow them out. If they're within 7 points, you're in trouble. So, you know.
We'll see what happens. You guys will probably listen to this after the game. So,
yeah.
You guys will know whether we're right or wrong.
Yep.
Okay.
What time's the game? 5:30?
Yeah, 5:30.
I'll have it up before then.
There you go. So. But can we expect people to really be listening
probably
on Super
not.
Bowl Sunday?
Probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah.
All right. Now we move on to our Fit Focus. Ooh, scary stuff this week. Found an article. Headline reads, human brains contain an entire plastic spoon's worth of nanoplastics.
This is insane.
So I was, I can't remember what I was on yesterday on internet, you know, and this popped up. And I read the headline, and I thought, wait a minute, I want to look into that. Clicked on it and was reading it, and first thing I thought of was, we got to talk about this on the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what they did is they studied, it was published in the Nature Medicine Journal, and it was researchers that studied brain samples from autopsies. So, you know, dead individuals, they, you know, maybe donate their brains to science, whatever. They studied the brains for the how much microplastics they had.
Right.
And they determined that the average brain has about an entire plastic spoon's worth of nanoplastics in it. And another thing they pointed out is that they've been doing these studies for a few years. They've done them multiple times.
Yeah.
And they said if they compare those totals to ones from 8 years ago, the brains today have 50% more plastic than 8 years ago. So, wow. Like 8 years ago, it was half a plastic spoon, and now it's a whole plastic spoon of plastic. Think about just shoving a plastic spoon in your brain.
Yeah, I know. It's like I imagine a plastic spoon in my brain, you know? That's. So the question I have is, and maybe this isn't in the article, my question I have is there anything you can do about it to get it out of there? Or if it's just forever?
Well, getting it out, the article doesn't talk about that. The article talks about limiting your exposure, which they say stop using things like plastic grocery bags, plastic utensils, you know, use glass for drinking.
Right.
Things like that, which I absolutely agree with.
Yeah.
But it doesn't talk about reducing your exposure, and I don't think that this study did anything along the lines of how to reduce exposure. Or, well, sorry, how to reduce the amount,
right.
Only how to reduce the exposure.
Yeah. Yeah, so it sounds like to me once it's in there, it's in there.
I wouldn't say that for sure, but I don't think we have any data to show otherwise.
Yeah.
It would be interesting, though, if the problem is you can't test somebody's brain for the level of microplastics and then test it again years later because you can't take pieces of people's brains and without them being already deceased.
Right. So you can't determine how much plastic's in someone's brain until they're dead.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't think you would be able to, unless they could figure out a way for it to show up on a scan. But I'm not sure if there's technology to do that or not. But I will say this, you know, limiting your exposure is absolute necessity.
Yeah.
Regardless of if it reduces it or not, you don't want it to go any higher. And I would, you know, it's kind of like the body has filtration processes that help filter out toxins and things. And, you know, you got to wonder that if you reduce the exposure over time, that your body may heal itself a little bit and may work some of those toxins out. Hard to say for sure, but.
Yeah, I looked up as we were talking, is that the presence of nanoplastics in the human body, including the brain, is an area of ongoing research. As of now, there are no established medical treatments specifically designed to remove nanoplastics from the brain or any other body part. Yeah, so they
just... So what you're saying is we're all just kind of screwed.
Yeah, yeah, and... and then it goes into ways to, you mentioned that you can reduce contact, you know, like not add to it.
Yeah, but, you know, some of the reading I've done on this topic is that the contact isn't necessarily the problem. Because if you think about it, let's say you are using a plastic spoon to eat your food. You're not eating the spoon.
Right.
You know? There isn't necessarily plastic going into your system with that. The problem becomes the like microplastics that end up in things we consume. Little bitty tiny pieces that are almost so small, you know, you can't even see them. And that does happen from a lot of times from food processing. You know, that can take place. Heat, you know, can change the properties of plastic, and a lot of times, I know you've talked about before, the really hot food in a plastic bag.
Right,
you know,
right.
Plastic can kind of leach into there. So there has to be something taking place to kind of transfer this plastic. I still don't think it's good to drink out of a plastic cup, for example.
Right.
And I don't drink out of plastic cups. However, I do think there are worse things we need to look out for, and a lot of it boils down to processed foods, like we talk about a lot.
Yeah.
They've done studies of foods that have the most microplastics in them.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't know where it is. On the desk in there in the office before we came out to do the podcast, you had a protein shake sitting on the desk.
Yeah.
What kind of protein shake was that?
That was a Core Power.
A Core Power Fairlife.
Mm-hmm.
So I was reading this study, and they studied, I think it was 1,000 different foods mm-hmm. on the levels of microplastics. And the most, the highest level of microplastics, there was, do you want to guess what it was?
The highest level of, I don't know how those levels are figured.
Density, you know, like the most microplastics amount.
Oh, in like, the, is it a percentage?
Yeah, kind of like a percentage.
I would, and like in the food?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to say the most density is probably be 1%.
No, like what food it was.
Oh, what food it was. I don't know. Core Power?
It was Fairlife protein shakes.
No way.
Positive, yeah.
No way. I had one sip.
That's going to go throw it away. No, I was surprised to see a ton of protein powders and protein shakes were high on the list.
Wow.
You could probably find it if you looked it up. It was a study to find the microplastic levels in food.
Yeah, I'm sitting here. I just did a quick search outside of the kind of similar, and it says microplastics can be found in various food items due to environmental contamination, breakdown of larger plastic debris. And here are some types of food that have been reported to contain microplastics. Seafood. Oh, wow. So some of this food gets it from the particles from their surroundings.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Some studies have detected microplastics in table salt.
Yes, I did read a little bit about that the other day. Like I said, it's processes and environmental things where these foods get their exposure. It's not necessarily like our cups and utensils and things, although those can be problematic as well.
This is interesting. So... particularly sea salt, which may absorb microplastics from ocean water. Interesting.
Yeah, and so that's very tough because everyone says, you know, to have sea salt.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because sea salt's healthier than, you know, table salt. But there's also environmental issues with sea salt. And I was reading the other day about some of the issues of heavy metals in the Himalayan salt because of how it's mined and processed. And so,
wow, this is kind of mind-blowing. Beer. Some studies have found traces of microplastics in beer attributed to the ingredients or processing methods used. Fruits and vegetables. While less common, there is evidence suggesting that certain fruits and vegetables might absorb microplastics through the soil or irrigation water contaminated with these particles.
Wow.
Then obviously the number one is processed foods.
Yes. Yeah.
Packaged snacks and other processed food may also be a source of microplastic exposure due to packaging materials or manufacturing processes.
Yeah. Whew.
That's crazy. I mean, I know petroleum is used to make plastic.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't quite understand. I mean, I'm not a chemist or understand this side of it. But petroleum is used to make like dyes. It's used in. It's an interesting ingredient, you know, that can be used for thousands of different things. I don't know who thought it was a good idea to actually put it in what we ingest, but. I don't understand the processing difference between making plastic and using it in, like, food dyes.
You know?
I mean, that's almost like I want to do some research. Is how is plastic made, and what role does petroleum use, and why is it used?
I know plastics. we take plastics for granted nowadays because they're everywhere. But plastics were a few decades ago marveled as a miracle invention.
And
they've changed a lot of things when it comes to manufacturing and getting certain products to people. So they had benefits there, but it's kind of like with everything that's new, we don't really know the negative effects until we get down the road a little ways. And, you know, we're seeing maybe some of the negative effects of all this plastic everywhere. And
well, I mean, it makes you think. I mean, I'm looking at, you know, I don't know if this material has plastic in it, or the woven material on my head has got plastic in it. There's pieces of this that are plastic, and there's pieces of that are plastic. You know, it's like it's everywhere. You know, I'm assuming that there has to be it has to be ingested. It's not through the skin.
I don't know that for sure.
Yeah.
But I would assume ingested is worse. I know chemicals from the water supply can get in through the skin.
Yeah.
So that's hard to know. But I just would say that to sum it up and to give a conclusion, the things that we always talk about are being as natural as possible with your food sources.
Yeah.
And while we can't ever 100% remove all the plastics from our food, we can make more natural choices, more healthy choices, less processed choices, and that is in turn going to lead to us also getting less plastics, along with a lot of other health benefits.
As you were talking, I found this. Microplastics are generally considered too large to penetrate healthy, intact skin. The outer layer of the skin serves as a barrier to protect against various environmental factors, including particulate matter. However, there are some considerations regarding microplastic skin exposure. Tropical products, such as cosmetics and personal care products, they can contain microplastic beads or particles. When applying to the skin, these can remain on the surface or be washed off, but are unlikely to penetrate deeply. Okay, so that's still not an issue. Environmental exposure. Microplastics present in an environment such as dust or airborne particles, may come in contact with skin, but again, will not typically penetrate it. Skin conditions. In case of damaged or compromised skin due to condition like eczema or wounds, there might be a larger risk of various substances, including microplastics, entering the body. So as research is ongoing, scientists continue to investigate potential health impacts from microplastic exposure through various routes, including ingestion, inhalation, breathing, rather than dermal absorption. While direct penetration of intact skin by microplastics is unlikely, it is essential to be mindful of the product's ingredients and environmental exposures that could contribute to overall plastic contamination in your life. Anyway, so it sounds like, for the most part, skin is a pretty good barrier, you know, from microplastics. So it's going to be used, it's going to be what you ingest or breathe in. That, and I guess, you know, microplastics can float through the air, I'm assuming.
Apparently. Yeah. It's just all around us.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. That's alarming, though. I mean, the other one I've heard is a credit card.
Oh, yeah.
Plastic can be in your body.
I've heard that, too. A spoon seems like it might be a little bit more than a credit card.
Yes.
So I think they've upped it. As these researchers have gone along, they're finding more. They've had to find a new example of how much plastic.
Well, and it's not just, they're not talking about the whole body. They're talking about the brain.
Yeah.
You know,
by itself.
That's by itself. So it's like someone put a spoon in a blender and then sprinkled it throughout your brain. I mean,
that's a good analogy.
A fine powder and just put it throughout the brain.
Pretty soon our brains will be entirely made of plastic.
Maybe they'll be okay, so does plastic cause tumors in the brain? You know, I don't know. Very interesting. Very interesting. So do you got any more thoughts on this?
Nope.
All right. Well, that was frightening.
Yeah, just a little bit. Just a little bit.
All right. So last month was... Oh, and we didn't have a show last week. You had a wake.
What?
Was last week you had to step out because you had something to go to?
Yeah, I had to go to a funeral.
A funeral, yeah. So we apologize for the week delay. But and just a heads up. So today is the 8th. What is the 8th?
Yes.
Okay. So we have the 15th. That will be a, we'll have to think about when we shoot that or when we record that one. And then the week of the 22nd, I'll be in a competition.
Okay.
So we'll have to, either you can do a solo or we'll just skip that week.
Okay.
All right. But anyway, so last month was Parker's carnivore month, and I'm very interested to hear how he feels it went. So give us the 10,000 foot view, and then we'll get into the details.
Okay, so the carnivore diet is a very basic, simple diet to follow. You get to pick from a small number of food groups. You can have meat, any meat you want. You can have eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have dairy products.
Okay.
And you have to pick between those things, but that's all you can have. You know, salt and seasonings, things like that. No sauces, just meat, eggs, dairy.
So let's talk about that for a moment. How difficult it is from a, let's go ahead and address the financial standpoint. How difficult is it to do that financially? Maybe it's not difficult at all. And how difficult is it to just eat dairy and meat?
Well, I'll tackle the difficulty to just eat dairy and meat first.
Okay.
And for me, I am an individual that enjoys meat, mm-hmm. dairy, and eggs. It is those three things are staples in my diet regardless.
Right.
All the time.
Right.
And so it was really just increasing more of those things that are already staples in my diet and backing off of any of the extras. And so it wasn't that difficult to eat the meat, the eggs, and the dairy. I had no problem getting plenty of those. The difficult piece is that when you do want something that deviates a little bit, you can't have it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was that is obviously challenging normally. It wasn't what I would call a major, just completely different diet than what I'm used to. But it just was different in that, you know, zero potential for junk food or... you know, really any major carbohydrate sources, no sugars, you know, things like that. I didn't find it that difficult.
Okay.
I've done it before for a month. Last January, right. I did it as well. And it felt very similar. With that said, I was excited for the time to come that I could eat some fruit and things like that. But I didn't think it was that difficult. I felt very good.
Okay. So... it didn't add any stress to your life. You weren't like sitting here going, man, I really want that X or Y.
It did not. No extra stress. If anything, it made things a little bit simpler.
Mm-hmm.
Because you kind of just know exactly what you're eating every day.
Yeah.
Because you can't eat anything different than that. So okay. Kind of simplified eating. Yeah.
And you already have the support structure in place where to get these foods. A lot of people, you know, like you're eating... all unpasteurized dairy,
mm-hmm.
right?
100%
unpasteurized. So a lot of people don't have access to unpasteurized, or you know, you've sourced those out and made your life easier. You've worked it into your schedule to make those trips to acquire those items.
Yes. So that is what I will say, and not 100%, but almost all of what I ate did not come from the grocery store.
Right.
Our meat, we raise our own beef, and the vast majority of what I ate from the meat perspective was beef.
Mm-hmm.
We have multiple sources for backyard chickens around mm-hmm. us, eggs. that are raised the right way. Mm-hmm. And same thing with the dairy. We have a source for some high quality raw milk that we not only drink the raw milk, but also use to make all of the other dairy products, butter, yogurt, other cheese, mm-hmm. things like that.
Does Amber make the cheese too?
Yes.
Wow. Impressive.
It is impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't claim to understand it, but I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. So, what would be your take on, I mean, did you have any friends or family that did the carnivore month that you knew about?
Well, my wife did it with me.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what was her take on it?
I would say that, see, it was her first time
uh-huh.
doing it. I think she enjoyed it, but I think she was ready for it to be over. Mm-hmm. Same thing. She mm-hmm. was ready for some fruits and vegetables again.
Yeah.
I didn't even know she was doing it, actually, until a couple days in, and I'm like, you know, you're not eating any of the other things. She's like, oh, I'm doing it with you. Okay. So that was great.
Yeah.
But like I said, I think she was ready for it to be over. She knows she felt really good.
Yeah.
So energy levels. And that's one thing. The biggest takeaway that I had from it, given that I already ate a pretty healthy diet, the biggest takeaway I had was that it completely changes the way your energy works. I had the most consistent energy levels ever in my life. Your energy levels are constant all the way throughout the day.
So you don't, if I remember you explain this, you don't have a really high or a really low low.
I don't even have a change at all.
Right.
It was weird where, because I'd get up early and come in to train at 4 a.m. usually, and I'll wake up and get out of bed and I'm just, like, literally if you talk to me, it'd be the same as you talking to me right now.
Right.
Right. Or 2 in the afternoon,
mm-hmm.
I feel the exact same.
Right.
Like, I get up and I just feel ready for the day. I feel awake and ready to go. However, I never had, like, a spike in energy. Like, I just feel amped.
Right.
You know, that never comes either. It's just a constant all the time.
Very interesting.
It is very interesting. I think it has to do probably with the blood sugar levels and the lack of the sugars and the carbohydrates to have the peaks and valleys. I just had a flat line.
So when you get into the end of the day, you're not feeling kind of run down?
Not run down at all. I'm feeling tired, like my body is ready to sleep and rest, but mm-hmm. not like, oh, I'm just run down and, you know, worn out type of thing.
Fascinating. So that would probably have a lot to do that you're getting virtually no carbs.
Yes.
Yeah.
I tracked my food
uh-huh.
for most of the month, and then I was able to put together my averages,
mm-hmm.
you know, what my average day looked like. And I was about 10% carbs.
10%.
Which came exclusively from dairy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that because that's about where my carbs are in my meal plans.
Yeah, about 10%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and probably coming mostly from dairy, maybe some
fruits. Mostly from dairy. So, you know, like I've always, I have people that's like fruit.
Yeah.
You know, so if they're going to get any carbs, I'll do that or.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. You know, the one thing I will say is they always, within 2 weeks, they'll tell me, I feel so good. You know, they're like, they don't have any, they feel, well, the first thing that happens, they lose all their water weight within a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
It just flushes out. And I'm assuming that's getting rid of all the inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just feels so good. And that's the immediate response to removing the carbs.
Yeah.
And then the process starts of actually, you know, whatever their goals are. But, yeah, so that's fascinating, you know, that it's very consistent for you.
Yeah. And that's one thing I noticed last year and noticed again this year. Very consistent energy levels.
So why not eat like that all the time?
For me, the reason I wouldn't eat like that all the time is because it depends on my goals.
Yeah.
And what I found this year, and I can kind of walk you through what my days look like. But I started out, we're coming off of the holiday season, coming off of some junk, coming off yeah. of kind of. But generally speaking, I still ate very well. Mm-hmm. And I was still very low body weight and pretty lean compared to what I wanted to be. And so a few days in, I found I was beginning to lose weight pretty quickly. And I realized that I had to become very intentional about getting enough of these foods in order to keep my weight up, because I didn't want to lose any weight.
Right.
And I was following somewhat of an intermittent fast. I would drink some milk in the morning, but otherwise my eating window would be within a 6 to 8 hour period every day. And so I was kind of following an intermittent fast. I was feeling a lot less, you know, bloated, felt myself getting leaner. The weight was just kind of falling off. You know, the inflammation, the water weight comes out of you. Like, I'm wearing my clothes, they feel really baggy, and it's just like I feel kind of dry, kind of lean. And that's great, but my goal isn't to always do that.
Right.
So if you're somebody who's looking for weight loss, dropping inflammation, leaning down, I think it's a fantastic diet, because it just happens almost without you trying.
Right.
I had to really, really try just to maintain a consistent weight. And I think I even still lost a little bit of weight.
Did you know that going in, or did you have to adjust in the first week?
I kind of had to adjust, because the first few days I was around between 2,000 and 2,500 calories, and it wasn't working for me. Like the low 2,000s. And I was losing weight, and I felt good, but I was like, I don't want to lose too much weight. I found myself down like 172 and about to hit 170. And I thought, man, like, I don't want to lose any more this month. So yeah. Then I started ratcheting up my calories, and I usually was close to around 3,000 every day. Then after that, the rest of the month.
Yeah. Okay. So 3,000 calories. And so you started the month at what weight?
Let me pull up my body scan here. I scanned on January 2nd because I believe January 1st was – I wasn't here January 1st.
Right.
So I came in and scanned January 2nd at 175.7.
Wow.
Okay. That was to begin.
Yeah, I know. Okay. And you came in and you ended up at 175 what?
0.7 to start.
Okay. And what did you end up with?
174.6.
So you lost a pound.
About a pound, yeah.
Okay. All right. That's not bad.
I ended up staying pretty consistent, but like I said, I had to really work to stay there.
Any other, and I don't want to take you out of your, how you want to present this, but I am curious about your skeletal muscle mass and your percentage body fat. What happened?
And that's, I did these scans, and I purposely didn't tell you so that you could find out live on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm very excited here.
So my skeletal muscle mass began at 86.9, and it ended at 85.8.
Interesting.
So it dropped by a pound during that month.
Okay. And how many days a week were you working out?
Three to four.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Strength stayed about the same.
Strength went up. Quite a bit.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I saw you the other day hitting like 350, 365 on your deadlifts for reps.
405.
Okay. 405.
The last 2 weeks. Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
And from that perspective, strength went up.
Okay.
But I think the biggest reason why strength went up was because I wasn't lifting very heavy throughout the last part of the year, because I could tell I had a lot of inflammation in my body.
Mm-hmm.
I told you about my struggles with my tennis elbow on my right arm. It was killing me. I couldn't do anything upper body related very heavy because of the tennis elbow. My body was just, I could tell it was kind of inflamed and kind of some aches and pains, you know, and so I wasn't lifting real heavy. So my inflammation went away completely when I started.
Like within a week?
I think it was day three, and my tennis elbow was gone.
Wow.
It's been going on for months, really bad the last couple months of the year, and in 3 days it was gone.
That's insane.
And then it was fine. And then I started really ramping up my lifting again, and a lot of strength came back by the end of the month that I didn't have at the beginning.
Wow.
Which is what really confuses me about this muscle mass total, is that I am a lot stronger than I was at the beginning of the month, yet this scan claims I lost a pound of muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that I can really hypothesize about this as I've been reflecting on it is, you talked about inflammation and the body releasing water, water weight coming off with no carbs.
Right.
And I think that's what kind of happened, is I lost a lot of water weight. Well, the cells in the muscles hold water.
Right.
And it's kind of like when you feel bloated up, but sometimes, like if you have a really high carb meal and you get up the next morning and you just feel kind of bloated and puffy, that's not body fat, right? That's your cells holding more water. They're more inflamed. And so what I'm wondering if happened is my muscle cells, you know, released some of their water they were holding. That's why I felt so dry and lean, and that's why the muscle weighed a little less, is because it had less water.
Could be.
I don't know, because I also, if you go into my intracellular fluid, it dropped by almost a pound and a half.
Wow. Yeah, that's...
So the fluid that my cells were holding on to dropped.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense with the way you were eating. So what food do you think you removed that that was causing the inflammation?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't know.
You really pretty clean.
I did. I was eating clean.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, because, you know, it's still... Yeah, I mean, it's been cleared up. And I noticed when the month ended and I started back on some fruits and other, you know, carbs, it kind of started to come back again for a day or two, and then it went away again. And so now it's fine.
Yeah.
It's been fine for a few days. But I couldn't tell you, because at first I thought, oh, well, maybe it's when it started to come back, I thought maybe it's the citrus, the fruits, because that's really what I ate a lot of the first couple of days afterwards, was the fruits. But then it went away again, and I've still been eating fruits. So,
yeah, interesting. Yeah, so a carnivore diet can heal you up.
100%, it did.
Yeah,
in that case for me, that's really the only ailment that I had going on.
Yeah,
I didn't really have anything else. You know, a lot of people will claim they follow this diet, they'll claim that it heals them from all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
But this is the only ailment I really had to test, and it did. It healed it.
I know. I've heard that, you know, people have had, like, eczema or some type of skin irritation, even some type of, what do you call it? It can be any type of skin irritation, even skin disease. And they go on a carnivore diet, and it disappears. You know, I mean, they've been going to doctors for years trying to solve their skin problems, and they just finally go on a carnivore diet and taken care of.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty fascinating.
You hear those if you do the research and you read and listen to people, a lot of people with stories like that.
Yeah. 100%. So, okay. All right. What other exciting things you want to share with me on this?
Well, so my body fat percentage, right?
Oh yeah. We haven't talked about
that. It went up by 0.6%. Okay. So it slightly increased. And so I did a little bit of digging, because this body scan breaks down by your arms, your torso, and your legs, lean and fat mass. And so I said, okay, if my muscle mass went down slightly and my body fat went up slightly, what's the story here? And so I looked, and let's start with the torso, right? Because most people think about body fat on the torso. My body fat on my torso did not go up. Where the body fat went up, according to this, was my left arm gained a half a pound of body fat.
Interesting.
I don't really understand it, but it claims that it did.
Okay.
And it claims that my right leg lost body fat, but my left leg gained body fat.
Huh. You know, the what is it? few days ago, this is semi-related, but I texted you about someone who had chemo done. How they didn't have they didn't have much body fat on them at all, and you know, I think they were at 10% or less. And after they came out of chemo, all their body fat repositioned into different areas. And I had to do some research on that. Like, why would that happen? You know, and I'm wondering if if I remember right, what was it that chemo did? Do you remember what I texted you? It was something. It does something to the body. And at the moment, let me see. I sent it to you just the other day. So I came across a study that says chemotherapy can alter your metabolism. So I'm wondering if the carnivore diet, can change your metabolism somewhat.
I believe that it does. I did some reflection and some reading. And I kind of been talking to my wife about this. As we come off of this diet, what do we need to do? What's the best way to come off of it? Not just, okay, it's over and we're just going to start eating whatever we want and, you know, not even think about it again. And the more I did some digging, the more I realized, you know, the body has two modes. One is anabolic. Mm-hmm. One is catabolic.
Right.
Anabolic is growth. Catabolic is the opposite of growth. It's shrinkage.
Right.
It can only be doing one or the other. And when you are, you know, lifting weights, trying to get stronger, trying to put on muscle mass, you're wanting to be in anabolic mode. They don't call them anabolic steroids for nothing. They're growth, right? They help induce growth. Eating in a calorie surplus, eating really high amounts of protein, lifting weights, these are all things that have anabolic purposes.
Right.
And that's great. We all want to have more muscle mass. But I believe that the carnivore diet is more of a catabolic style diet where your body doesn't have the carbohydrates to burn as energy. So the body begins to burn itself, which is fat stores typically first, but it begins to burn itself for energy. Mm-hmm. That's a catabolic state.
Yeah.
When your body's burning its pieces of itself off. When the body is in a state of fat burning mode, the metabolism is going to go down. And here's why. Because when the body is having to burn itself in order to get energy to survive, it instinctively thinks it's in survival mode.
Right.
Because it thinks, well, we're having to burn ourselves to survive. We better drop our metabolism or else we'll run out of resources. The body doesn't intuitively know that we're doing this on purpose if we're not eating enough food. You know, we're not eating it if we're in calorie deficit. It assumes we're doing that because we don't have food available.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So when we're in this calorie deficit, our metabolism decreases, but we do get to go into catabolic mode. So now someone would ask, well, why would we want to be in catabolic mode? Well, getting healthier mm-hmm. is the answer.
Yeah.
Because we have to be in catabolic mode. Most people would think, well, that's how we lose weight. And that's very true. You do lose weight that way. But another thing that also happens when you're in catabolic mode and you're burning parts of your body is that your body breaks down the pieces that it most needs to get rid of first, and it keeps the most important pieces around second. Right? Your body, when it goes into catabolic mode and it's burning off itself for energy, it's not going to start burning off, you know, your lungs or your heart or your eyeballs or something that's important. Your right. muscle mass, your bone mass. It's not going to burn these things for energy because then it would actually be destroying itself.
Right.
It'll burn the things first that it doesn't need. Body fat it doesn't need. Right?
Right.
Diseased cells
yeah.
it doesn't need.
Right.
It'll burn these things first. And so the reason why something like this, so many people on a carnivore diet achieve greater health, is because they allow their body to go in a catabolic state. They don't have the sugars, the energy coming in. Their body's having to go into fat-burning mode, burning itself off in order to get energy. They're losing weight. They have a hard time keeping weight on. The metabolism's somewhat slowing down. but they're getting rid of the disease. They're getting rid of the ailments. They're getting rid of the body fat.
And toxins and stuff
and
like
toxins
that.
And toxins. Yeah. And all the things the body is catabolizing itself. It's looking, it's going out saying, okay, we need to find stuff to burn off. Let's burn off this disease, that disease. It's the same thing that happens during fasting. Mm-hmm. It's the same reason why people have reported, you know, a cancer tumor shrinking from fasting and things like that, because the body begins to eat those things up.
Right.
In a catabolic state.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's, I think, the point of this. Now, I tried to turn it into more of an anabolic state and eat in a calorie surplus and try to put on muscle and things. Didn't really work. Now, I got a little bit stronger. But I think the best use for a diet like this is when you're wanting to improve your health, you're wanting to lose weight, you're wanting to try to heal yourself from ailments. I think it's a fantastic diet for that. However, I can see how the importance for the carbohydrates, the sugars, the calorie surplus, the metabolism boost can be really important for becoming anabolic, putting muscle on. You'll right. also be building other things too. You'll be building fat mass as well as you're building muscle mass. You'll be building everything up, but you're doing that for a specific purpose, which is to make yourself stronger.
Right.
So it's like when you're catabolic, you're breaking stuff down, you're breaking everything down. Whenever you're anabolic, you're building everything up.
Right.
It's just you're trying to fix your ratios. Think about, you know, how you had to add in carbs in order to keep gaining weight when you were trying to put on muscle. You reached a point in your weight gain and your muscle gain where you hit a wall, mm-hmm. and if you didn't increase your carbohydrates, you weren't going to gain any weight.
Right. Yeah, that was 100%. I was like, I got stagnant for about a year, you know, and I had to learn to eat more, and it took me time, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, what is healthy is to be, you know, doing the intermittent fasting and eating, you know, a very clean, but a carnivore, I want to say maybe it's a carnivore focused diet, but that's going to, you know, but, you know, include some, you know, vegetables and fruits and stuff like that. But, you know, I think it does come down to what are your goals. And when you have goals, maybe the goals are more short term, but the long term is to be eating in a more of a very clean or how do I want to say this? I would say intermittent fasting can be more of a long-term approach because, you know, you're going to be eating in that where the body is constantly maintaining itself and you're keeping high levels. So as you go forward throughout the rest of the year, you've included some fruits now.
Yes. Yeah. Fruits and honey.
Yeah.
You know, two really big pieces that I now include.
Anything else you've added back in?
On a regular basis, no.
Okay. So your diet is still not hop, skip, and a jump away from doing carnivore.
Maybe a little bit of vegetables, too, you know, so far. But pretty much, yeah. It's still very similar. And that's what I will say is when it comes to, you know, carnivore itself, maybe really easy to put your body in a catabolic state, but you can still be in an anabolic state eating very clean.
Right.
Right. And so I think the energy coming from the body being able to use the carbs, the fruit and the honey as energy allows it to use the proteins and the fats that you're getting to build body tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're not getting any of those carbs for energy, the body's forced to burn those mm-hmm. as its energy. And therefore, right. there's not much left for the body to use to build the lean tissue.
I think what you just said was pretty profound, and that is using carbs to build tissue. You know, when you're trying to bulk up. I have two clients right now that are trying to get a little more size. And one of them's gone from 250 to like 260, and the other one's gone from like 190 to 205. And that's because they have a higher carb, and they're trying to add muscle and get stronger, and then at some point they want to reverse that, right? So that's pretty, I think, I don't know if you met it that way, but that's a pretty, you know, do you think you can eat enough fat to build tissue?
Yes, I think that you can. I think it's maybe more difficult.
Yeah, a lot more difficult.
But I think that you can. And I would say it was possible, but it was very hard.
Yeah.
I was finding myself by the end of the month taking in, you know, over 3,000, you know, low 3,000s of calories and not gaining any weight.
Yeah.
And actually still struggling with potentially losing some weight.
Yeah.
And so it would have been hard to get that much food in.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like keep adding, you know, I'm going to go to, you know, 4,000 calories, you know, when, you know, it's just like at some point it starts to become impractical to function.
Yes.
You know, because you
you can eat something like, you know, honey and a couple spoonfuls of honey, and that's a lot of extra calories, a lot of extra sugars, freeze up those proteins and fats to go to building muscle. And it's just way easier if you're looking to build muscle.
Right, right.
I would agree with that 100%. It's kind of like putting a roadblock in front of yourself and then having to get over the roadblock versus just remove the roadblock. You know, if you're trying to build muscle, have the carbs. I don't think that if you're trying to bulk up, this is the best diet by any means.
Right, 100%. Yeah. But when it's time for Mr. Matt Wasko to shed some weight, I'll be doing some carnivore-focused diets.
Uh-oh, when's that going to be?
I don't know. Like I said, I've been bulking up for quite some time trying to get to those heavier weights, and I'm finally in the last probably month and a half feeling pretty strong, you know, stronger than I've felt in a while. And so I'm looking forward to this tournament. I haven't even told you about it. Have I?
You have.
Have I?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, you know, this is an untested tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And but I didn't care. I wanted something under my belt.
Yeah.
You know, go to compete. So I'm not going to worry about anything but just doing the best I can. And I'll probably be the only one in my age group bracket anyway. But so I'm just going to go down there. I'm going to take it seriously, but I'm not going to stress about it. And I just want to get something under my belt, you know, as I'm getting ready for the state. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So any other nuggets?
Well, I did want to go over something, because whenever I read about this diet, I think the number one thing, especially for younger people when it comes to following a diet like this, their biggest hang up is the cost.
Yes.
And you asked about the cost the very beginning, and we didn't get into it.
Right.
But I also wanted to show people that it's not as expensive as it may seem.
Okay.
Did you see my paper there?
No, I can't see it upside down.
So I want to ask you, I wrote down the cost every day of what it costs me. This is the price that I pay.
Was it two meals a day or three?
It was usually between two and three.
Okay.
You know, sometimes three, sometimes two. But I was having milk, eggs, and we do raise our own beef, but I put in the price as if I was having to buy it from myself.
Okay, gotcha.
Do you want to guess what the average price per day was?
Let me do some quick math in my head here. So protein is kind of, you know, if you go buy protein, it's not cheap.
No.
Okay. And so did you put the price of your beef at grocery store levels or what you paid for it? Or what your dad sells it for?
What I would have paid if I had to buy it from myself, like full price.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. All
like okay. If you bought from us, like what?
And most of it was hamburger?
Well, I use it all the same, because you pay the same. Whether you pay, you know, if you buy a side of beef, half a beef, or quarter beef, it's just per pound.
So you did it as if you bought a half a cow.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Because that's what we do.
Yeah.
We get a half at a time.
Okay. So Because that would be very different if you're buying meat as you eat it.
That is true.
Yeah.
That is true.
Are you doing it at the price level that your dad sells it for, or what you would go out and get it from somewhere else? Like a processing plant?
What we sell it for.
Okay. Yeah. All right. All right. So I'm going to say...
And eggs are what we buy them for. Milk's with what we buy them for. And factored that price into the dairy products we make, too.
If I remember right, a pound of steak, if you're talking, you know, let's just say it's $6.50 a pound with the processing and the per pound weight, and you're going to get 96, let's say 16 ounces is going to have like 106 grams of protein, 116?
Somewhere around there, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So 116 grams of protein. Okay, so 650, and then if you did, you didn't do any protein shakes.
No, I didn't do any protein shakes.
Yeah, that would be a breaking of the carnivore diet. I'm going to guess it was probably, I want to say 12, but that'd be 100. What was your average protein intake?
223 grams a day.
Okay. So I'm going to say $13.
$11.30.
Okay. All right. That's pretty good.
And I basically, if you take averages, had a half a dozen eggs a day, a half gallon of milk a day, between a pound and, you know, pound and a quarter of meat a day, and then some, you know, cheese and yogurt here and there. That was about what I had.
Okay.
And I ate average about 3,000 calories a day.
Okay.
Which is a lot more than most people would eat.
Yeah.
And still only cost me $11.30. I sourced all my food from very high quality, you know, natural sources like we would recommend you to source our food. And it only costs $11.30.
Yeah.
Per day.
Yeah.
I don't even think you can get Chipotle for that anymore.
No. No. And it's just, you know, your meat, which is the big one, you're going to have to spend, you know, $1,500 up front to get it, and then divide it over 6 months to a year.
You have meat for a year.
Yeah.
So, now,
the majority of people who don't buy a cow, your meat, that's going to double your meat price.
It's going to be a lot more expensive.
Yeah.
So, but you have to be strategic about how you do
this. So you'd probably be looking at, like, your meat itself would have been double, so you would have probably been sitting at like 17 or 18.
Yeah, maybe. You've got to be strategic, and you've got to go about sourcing it the right way. If you walk into, you know, Whole Foods and buy the most expensive meat that they have, or the most expensive eggs, most expensive milk, which you can't even get raw milk in the store, but you would be spending way more money.
Yeah.
So you have to be resourceful, like you said. Yeah. You have to search these things out, find the places where you can cut out the middlemen, and, you know, find quality sources from local people.
Yeah.
But if you do that, it can be done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And if you did go just buy the absolute cheapest that you could buy of cheapest meat and eggs and dairy, you know, you could do it even cheaper than this. If you bought the, you know, 73% ground beef and the, you know, the basic store-bought eggs and, you know, pasteurized milk, it would be even cheaper than this. I wouldn't recommend you doing that unless you literally could not afford it, but...
I've run across that several people have had inflammation issues with store-bought dairy, and I was thinking, well, try some unpasteurized dairy. I think you'll have different results.
Yeah. Most people do.
Yeah, most people do. So, let's think about... You've worked to put yourself in the position to be strategic. Okay. You've strategically approached this. So why don't you give a couple tips of how you can become strategic and get these kind of prices? Like, you know, get yourself in the position to buy the half a cow, to, you know, source your dairy. What tips would you give?
You know, I think it starts out with just being intentional.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's out there.
Yeah.
You know the struggles that we've went through to source our raw milk.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's not like we've just had the exact same place for years and just, you know, it's super easy. Sometimes places do have it, then they don't, then you got to find another place. It's being very intentional. It's mm-hmm. knowing that no matter what, we are going to get raw milk and we are going to find a place that has it. And we are going to go, you know, go to that place if we have to, and mm-hmm. we're going to do it.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes. And so I just think it's knowing that I'm not going to settle for the convenience of the grocery store. I'm not going to settle for just, oh, I can walk in and grab something off the shelf and have it in 2 minutes and it's easy, it's cheap, and then I'm back home.
Right.
I'm going to make time, make it a priority in my life. Whatever you make a priority for, you'll be able to do.
Right.
And so I make it a priority. Eggs, same thing. I mean, you know, I found our current person we get eggs from on Facebook Marketplace
mm-hmm.
says, oh, I have some extra eggs, you know. And I say, oh, where are you? You know, if it turns out it's right down the road from me. Okay, great, you know, and start getting some every week. That's what I'm going to do when I leave here, go pick up my eggs for the week from her.
Right.
You know, and there are lots of people that sell meat too, you know. And people don't know that. People don't know that they can go down the street to a farmer and buy, you know, a half of a cow, you know, buy it on a share.
Right.
And then you can do that. And it's a lot, both you get the cheaper meat and the farmer makes more money than if they were selling to the grocery stores.
Right.
You know, and so, but it's better for both sides.
Right.
And you just have to search that out, you know, talk to people, get connections. Some of the best things is just be around other people who have the same beliefs as you. We have shared sources for where we get things with each other. Other people have shared sources with us. That's how we found the farmer's market, the Amish farmer's mm-hmm. market was right. a common friend of ours
right.
that shared that information with us. And we ended up, you know, being able to go there to source some food. There's no like specific instructions to follow. It's not like go to the grocery store and like get this brand and this thing, because it's different for everybody. What we find is local to us, you know, so we're up in Grain Valley. We're 25, 30 minutes away from where we are right here in Lee Summit.
Right.
You know, you're over on the Kansas side.
Right.
So you're not going to want to drive all the way over to where I am mm-hmm. to get some eggs.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But you may be able to find eggs close to where you are.
Right.
You know.
I think it comes down, what you said, be intentional about it. I think that has to be based on priorities. Is it a priority? You know.
And for us, it 100% is.
Yeah. And, you know, as you, because you're trying to live as healthy as you can be. And I understand priorities are, they can be mitigated by stress. They can, you know, be compromised by, you know, distance and money and those type of things. But you made a point, is like, this is almost to the point, this is not an option, right? Or let's say pasteurized is not an option. This is, we will get our unpasteurized milk. Okay. And so, you know, there might be times that you have to settle, you know, but you're going to find your source. And I think there's something to be said in that. It's where you have to take your health seriously. So, I mean, considering I didn't know a lot about the microplastics for the majority of my life, because no one talked about them until the last 5 years. You know, I'm probably got a head full of a couple spoons, you know, and you might have like a half of a credit card, you know, who knows. But, you know, and that's the thing, is like, once you understand it and you realize that our food and the way we eat and basically everything around us is not for our benefit, you have to be intentional about it to overcome it. It has to be a priority, which is really a crime that we're in this scenario.
Yeah, it would be convenient. It would be very handy if you could just walk in every grocery store and know that all the products were, you know, the best quality stuff for you.
Yeah.
That's not the case, you know. And even the same thing with, you know, don't think just because you're going to a local farm down the road that you automatically have the best quality stuff either. Mm. You know, that's a thing. You have to do your due diligence there and talk to the people and get to know them and you know, learn about how they actually produce their products.
Mm-hmm. What would be some questions that someone should ask?
It depends on what you're looking for.
If you're buying you're buying beef, would you ask them about what they feed them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
Is there anything else you would ask about how they raise their beef that would be important?
Biggest things are, you know, things like hormone implants, antibiotics, feed sources. Because if you think about it, you've got, it's kind of a spectrum, right? And if you consider commercially raised meat that the big, you know, feedlots raise and that you find in the grocery store, the way that that's raised is so far removed from the natural way that a cow would live and would live its life that it's a completely different product, right? And there's things that you don't even think about. You drive down the road and you see a cow standing in a field, you know, eating grass, and you think like, oh, they just, you know, kill that, cut it up, and then that meat ends up, that's what we eat. Not necessarily. So that can happen, but a lot of your commercial beef producers, they're all focused on getting the most beef the cheapest.
Right.
And there are common things that are done. If you implant the cattle with hormones, it can make them grow faster. And that's a very, very common thing to do. Implant them with chips. It's kind of like giving a human steroids or something.
Right.
Right. It causes them to grow faster, get bigger faster, right? Growth hormone, things like that.
Right.
And they will implant them with hormones. And they will do that to get them to grow faster, right?
Right.
That's not something that you want. You don't want that all pumped in your food.
Right.
Right? Another thing that a lot of them will do is they will put antibiotics in the feed. And the reason they do this is because the cattle are in the type of environments where they are very sick. They get sick a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so to keep them healthy, they will put antibiotics in their feed, all their feed. So what ends up happening is that antibiotics gets into their food, right? Or into their meat over time.
Right.
It's in their food, and then they eat it, and it gets into their meat. So then when you're eating the meat, you got antibiotics that you're eating. And that's why we have a lot of antibiotic-resistant diseases coming up. It's because a lot of these animals are fed high levels of antibiotics to keep them alive, essentially. And those are some of the lesser-known things that people don't know about.
Right.
You know, how are the cattle raised generally? You know, a lot of places will raise up their cattle very, very quickly, and they will feed them a ton of, you know, they will feed them a lot from an early age, a ton of grains and things that they shouldn't be eating at a young age, and grow them up very quickly. The quicker they can grow them, the better their bottom line.
Right.
Right. But animals aren't, they're not meant to grow that quickly.
Right.
Right. They're meant to be raised more out on grass most of the time, most of their life, up slowly over a couple years.
Yeah.
And then butchered. You ever notice you go to the store and you see like the bright pink meat versus the darker purple?
Mm-hmm.
Darker purple is a animal that's grown more under control the way it should have. The bright pink comes from an animal that's usually grown very, very quickly.
Interesting.
And so there are little details like that that people don't even really know to ask.
Yeah.
And you think like, oh, well, is it raised, you know, is it natural? Well, whose definition of natural?
Right.
Right? But if you know some of these things, like, hey, do you give it hormones? Do you get antibiotics? And most of your small farmers around here that you're getting beef from aren't going to do that. But you never know.
Yeah. And most of your small farmers aren't going to feed them antibiotics.
No. Most of the time, no. And because why would you feed them antibiotics unless you needed to?
Yeah.
You know, we've never fed any of our antibiotics because they don't get sick.
Yeah.
Because they're raised the right way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So the process that you are raising them with is that you let them the grass fed.
Yeah.
So Do you put any grain in them at some point?
They do towards the end. Towards they get the a little end. Bit of grain and alfalfa, which okay. is just adds some marbling and some extra nutrition okay. for them.
Interesting.
They're not 100% grass-fed.
Okay.
But they're, you know, 90%.
So that's, is that just to give some marbling to the meat?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay. And what if you didn't feed them the grain? What would be the disadvantage?
Meat ends up typically being a lot tougher.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. See, I'm learning a lot, folks. Okay, so then let's say you're going to buy your dairy. Okay. First thing you're going to want to know is it because you're not probably now. For example, we both have been to Red Bridge Methodist Church, mm-hmm. and all their stuff is unpasteurized.
Mm-hmm.
They all make it, you know, so you can buy it there. You know, farmer's market type situation where you're going to get unpasteurized milk. Or dairy products, but I know you've sourced out a couple different milk areas. Is there any questions you ask about the raw milk?
Well, I mean, ask if it's raw, right? That's the first thing.
First thing,
I want it to be
100%.
Pasteurized.
Yeah.
Beyond that, you know, you want to ask about how they milk, and the reason is because you just want to make sure that it's clean and it's done the right way. You know, they make sure that they clean the cattle off, you know, especially this time of year when it's wet, the cattle are very muddy, right? You don't want any mud or anything. You know, they clean them down. They kind of sanitize the udders. You know, they get the milk going in. They make sure they have sanitary processes about how they do that. That's the first thing. The second thing, also how they keep their cattle, you know, is very important, the breed of the cattle. So typically the most sought after milk is the Jersey breed. That's the breed of cattle. So you might ask what kind of breed they have. And not that there's a bad breed. Same thing with beef. That's one thing we didn't cover on beef is the breed of the beef. And that's important too, but lesser so. But the breed of the cow is important because the Jerseys are known to give more cream.
Okay.
And the Jerseys are also known, they can have a certain enzyme. It's called A2A2. It's known to be easier to digest.
Better for your gut.
Yes.
Okay.
No, I haven't had any problems with A1, A2.
Yeah.
But that's the other kind of enzyme is A1, A2. So, you know, that would be a question to ask if you are worried about that. The cleanliness, the breed, you know, what they feed them is important too.
Mm-hmm.
What you're going to find, though, is, you know, you don't really find dairy cows that are all grass-fed.
Mm-hmm.
And nor should you really want that because in the wintertime, they can't get the amount of milk production that they need through 100% grass-fed. But, you know, if you're mostly grass-fed, it's a certain percentage. You know, that's what they call grass-fed. You know, grass-fed is not typically 100% grass-fed. Grass-fed just means they follow a certain percentage of grass-fed. And so a lot of times they'll feed some grain to get them to produce enough milk.
Right.
Otherwise, they won't. So basically, I was 33% protein,
mm-hmm.
11% on carbs, and 56% on fats.
Okay. So our fats, you know, like if you have an egg, it's going to be 5 grams times 9, so that's 45 calories, and your egg is 6 times 4, that's 24. So that's where you're getting that breakdown, that higher fat.
Yeah, I would say a little bit from everything because you got that in the eggs. You got the milk, which was 1 gram of fat per ounce, half a gallon-ish, so 64.
So most of your fat was from milk. Maybe cheese.
Not most.
Cheese.
Uh-uh. Cheese. About a third of it from milk.
Okay.
But honestly, the meat, because, you know, ground beef or, you know, whatever meat is roughly 5 or 6 grams. Per ounce, if you have a pound of it, that's over 100.
Okay.
Right there, right around 100.
All right, so carnivore diet, you're looking at a macro breakdown of 33, 10, and 55, or 35, 10, and 55, somewhere around there.
Yeah, somewhere around there, 30, 10, and 60, or something like that. I tried to go a little bit higher protein than a lot of people do on a carnivore. Because I was trying to build muscle,
mm-hmm.
Even though I was working against nature kind of on that one. But
so you basically just maintained.
I did. It really, yeah. We can nitpick some of these little details, but I basically maintained. I will say that I always tell people to use the mirror test, as in look in the mirror and look at yourself. That's your truest test, not the scale, not the scan. And I would say, unless I'm mistaken, I was the leanest I'd ever been in my entire life on the last day, carnivore diet.
Wait, what was your percentage of body fat?
11.
11? You've been lower than that, haven't you?
On the scanner, I have, but like I said, I'm just going off how I looked.
Yeah.
You know, really the most shredded I think I've ever been. I'm still there. It's only a week later. I'm still pretty dang shredded. But I was kind of surprised to see that.
Yeah. Well, you know, and our scan can probably be off by a couple percentage points, because I'd say you're probably more like around an 8 or a 9.
Well, it was weird because I scanned earlier in the summer at a 7. And I don't think I was any leaner then than I am now.
Yeah.
So I don't know why. I don't know. But yeah. Like I said, I'm not putting a lot of stock into the scanner, but it's interesting info nonetheless.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, the only way you can get even more accurate is like they do like sink you in water and do these counterbalance things. I can't remember what that process is. Yeah, but the eye test is good, and so it was a good experiment. So are you going to wait 1 year to do it again?
Yeah, I won't do it again until next January.
Yeah.
You know, I will say this. You know, I do it for a reason, and let me go back a little bit here, because a lot of people probably, that's the biggest question, like, why are you doing it?
Right.
And it's not something where I think I need it. I think it's the most healthy diet ever for me, and it's the perfect diet. Because if it was, I'd follow it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I only do it for a month. And that's because I like the discipline factor.
Mm-hmm.
It forces me to only eat these foods. I don't have other options. I have to keep my willpower to do it for a whole month. I know it's only a month. I know there's an end in sight. I can force myself to do it for a month.
Right.
Number two, I do think for a lot of people, it's a very helpful diet to follow. Not going to recommend it to everybody, but the average person that comes in and is unhealthy, is overweight, is deconditioned, you put them on a carnivore diet, they're going to see very quick improvements and major improvements. And that's one of the reasons why I want to follow it, is because I want to understand what it's like to be on it, so that when I do recommend it or something very similar to it for people, I can speak from experience.
Yeah.
It's just like I don't coach people to do exercises in the gym that are stuff I haven't ever done before.
Right.
I need to know how it feels, what it's like to perform the exercise before I can coach it. I need to know what it's like to do the carnivore diet before I can coach people on it, and the results that they're going to get and kind of how they're going to feel. And that's why I think it's important to do it. And because January is World Carnivore Month, coined by Dr. Sean Baker, who's kind of the father of the carnivore diet, so to speak. He's been doing the carnivore diet for many decades, and I've listened to a lot of what he has to say about the carnivore diet, and I think it has a lot of benefits. I don't agree with him 100%, but I think it's a lot better than most diets out there.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Well, that'll be another show, because I'd love to know what you disagree with him on.
On Dr. Sean Baker?
Uh-huh.
Well, briefly, we could talk deeper another time, but briefly, I don't believe that the human body is best suited with only meat, eggs, and dairy. I do believe the human body was meant to have some carbs, some fruit, mm-hmm. some honey, some vegetables, certain mm-hmm. vegetables. I do believe that in its peak performance that it's supposed to have some of those things.
Right.
It doesn't have to. You can be very healthy without it, and he's had many great athletic feats eating a carnivore diet. I just believe that the perfect human diet for me
mm-hmm.
involves some fruit and some honey and some vegetables.
Interesting. Yeah, we'll have to have another, but that's another show, or we'll bring it up in another show. But all right, well, Episode 51's in the books.
That's all you want to know about a carnivore diet?
That's all I want to know about, unless you got something else.
No, I don't have anything.
Oh, okay.
I was. You said you were going to interview me, so I said, "Okay, I got my data, but that's it."
Well, you told me, you know, how many eggs and how many red meat. What was the average amount of red meat you had per day?
Between a pound and a pound and a quarter. I rarely ever hit a pound and a half, but I did a couple times.
Okay. Pound and a quarter. That's decent size amount of red meat.
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
You're looking at basically 8 pounds of red meat a week.
Yeah. That was in one meal.
That was one meal.
Yeah.
So did you have more than 1 pound of meat a day?
Huh.
Oh, okay.
That I only ate meat one meal, typically. Oh,
okay. All right. Okay.
So what I did was I ate my meat in one meal, I ate my eggs in one meal, and then I kind of drank my milk throughout the day, including some in the morning. But I eat like a lunch and a dinner.
Yeah. And it was like, you said, 6 eggs a day?
Yeah, about, you know, average.
Okay, so you're looking at 3.5 dozen?
A week?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good, man.
I should have put the numbers down on how many, I can't remember what it was, but we tracked, you know, how many as a family we went through. I can't remember. It was a lot of eggs. We were eating a dozen a day there when that was going on. Cause my son will eat a couple. My wife will eat 3 or 4. I'll eat 6. I mean,
we should have Amber right here with you.
Yeah.
We should have her because I would have loved to get the female perspective.
That would be good for her to give that perspective because of the people that I know that have done this, it's almost all men that talk about it and talk about the positives. And so it'd be good for her to talk a little bit to the women about, you know, what she experienced.
Yeah. At some point we'll get the wives on here.
That would be a great idea. That's a good idea. We can do that at some point.
We'll get the wives on here and we'll
meet
ask
the missus.
Them and we'll ask them how it feels to be married to a trainer.
Oh, I bet they could go back and forth with some stories.
Yeah, yeah. My wife would say, "Oh, I'm always rubbing his back." You know, if I tell her, "Oh, I did, you know, X and X on the bench or shoulder press today." "Oh, I'll be rubbing your back tonight." So I'm always be like, "Your muscles are so hard." I'm like, "I know. This is what it is." So, all right, guys. Well, I had a good time interviewing Parker on his carnivore month. Very exciting stuff. I learned a lot, especially that I want to get milk from Jersey cows because I like cream.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I do like cream.
You didn't know that.
Huh? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
And nothing wrong with Holstein milk, but, you know, higher cream percentage.
Yeah, and I do know, like, a lot of people want that A2,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah,
because supposedly it's good for your gut. But and a lot of good stuff. I hope you guys learned something today. I always try to ask Parker questions that I don't know because I think most people don't know. So,
okay. Well, thanks for joining us, guys. Root the Chiefs on to a Super Bowl victory. Hopefully next time we're here, we're celebrating a victory.
All right, guys. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hey, look at you. You've completed another milestone by finishing this episode of Loading the Bar. Your future self thanks you profusely. Loading the Bar is podcasted from Lee Summit, Missouri. Email us at cpt.kansascity@gmail.com. Forge ahead and share your progress. And we'll see you back here for another episode of Loading the Bar.